Thanks again for coming out. My name is Rod. I'm one of the co-organizers of the Nashville Bitcoin Meetup alongside Mills. And our goal was just to kind of get together once a month and talk about Bitcoin. And more importantly, gathering local Bitcoiners together, as well as Bitcoiners that were traveling through Nashville, Tennessee. If you guys don't know, this is Matt O'Dell. Matt's an independent Bitcoin and privacy advocate. He's also the co-host of Rabbit Hole Recap, which is every Thursday. He also does Citadel Dispatch, which if you go to citadeldispatch.com. And then Stefan Lavera, he's the managing director at Swan Bitcoin International. He's also got another one of the top Bitcoin podcasts out there that's super friendly to Bitcoin curious folks, as well as if you're really deep down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, highly recommend checking out his podcast.
Okay, you got it. You ready for a story?
Yeah, let's go.
So I don't even know if you remember this. This was about 3 or 4 years ago. Matt and I are in New York, and I think Marty was there as well. And we're grabbing a beer at a bar ahead of a dinner. And of course, I'm selfish and I want to get credit card points. And so I'm like, I'll take care of the tab. You just Venmo me. No big deal. And then like a damn James Dean sociopath, he rolls out a wad of cash and flips me a $20 bill and says, keep the change. And I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And so, and then I was like, why do you carry cash with you? Nobody carries cash with them anymore. And then in classic Matt fashion, he goes on this huge diatribe about cash is disappearing. Cash is the last self-preservation, privacy-centric, convenient currency we have. And like next
cash is king.
Cash is king. And so it helped me go down my little journey as well. So I guess my first question, and then I'll ask Stefan as well the same, which is the topic, but specifically to you, why does Bitcoin privacy matter?
So financial privacy, why is financial privacy important? Financial privacy is important because if you go to a restaurant and you buy a sandwich, they shouldn't know your salary. They shouldn't know your net worth. And at the same time, your boss shouldn't know how much, you know, what you're buying or what you're doing on a Friday night. I think that's a very simple concept for people. I think if you start to think about it, you realize that'd be ridiculous if both of those parties knew the other information. And unfortunately, this move to credit cards has had this experience where you basically have these surveillance companies, they call themselves credit card companies, but you have these surveillance companies that are keeping track of every single transaction you make. They're selling it to marketers. They're not storing it securely. And it's being shared around. And if you look at your credit card statement, you can tell everything about a person. I don't know if you've looked at it very closely. Maybe if you have like a close friend, you can look at theirs, you know, share it. And have them kind of just look into that. So when you combine that with the fact that we're removing cash from the system, both governments are kind of pushing against it, but also just out of a convenience thing, people are choosing not to use cash. You know, in our everyday lives, what we see is we see like basically a privacy versus convenience trade-off. You're deciding if you're going to be more convenient versus more private. I feel that we're entering kind of a dark period and people do not realize that. And Bitcoin to me offers kind of an escape from that situation, because you don't have to rely on the fact that a government allows you to use cash. You don't have to rely on the fact that you can get access to cash, because Bitcoin is non-state money. But at the same time, Bitcoin is not default private. Bitcoin, every Bitcoin transaction you make is on this ledger. We call it the blockchain.
The time chain.
The blockchain we expect as Bitcoin bulls to last longer than all of us. It's going to be forever. So even if you're not exposed today, someone could come back and look back at that chain and you could be exposed in 5 years, 6 years, and it could come back to bite you. So it's really important, I think, for people to realize today that they should take steps. And there are easy steps you can take to improve your privacy situation so that in the future you're not as exposed.
Yeah, cool. Okay, let's see if this works. I think this is all right. Okay, so yeah, look, I broadly agree with Matt there. I think there's a lot of personal implications for all of us that we have to think about when we are stacking and spending sats. And it could come back to bite you in the ass later if you spend in a non-private way now. So those are things to consider. It could be things like things that are totally okay now, but imagine in 5 or 10 years' time, the conversation has shifted. And now what you did 5 or 10 years ago is now that's a cancelable offense. And so we're starting to see that as well with the pressure of things like YouTube as well. So they're trying to shut down anyone who is talking against the hysteria, shut down. And now anyone who's a climate denier, demonetized. And it starts in a certain process, right? They'll start with demonetizing and then they go to canceling. So that's kind of the censorship risk that we all face in the internet today. And essentially, if they silence you online, and especially if they locked you in your home, how are you going to talk to anyone? So that's one angle of it. And I think just to add to that aspect, obviously I agree with Matt on the personal privacy elements of this, but it's also as a system, right? So if you believe in Bitcoin as a system, one of the things we talk about is this idea of Bitcoin as permissionless. Now, what would happen if, say, it were feasible for mining pools to enforce whitelists or blacklists, meaning this transaction must go to a whitelisted address or it may not go to a blacklisted address, as an example, or to a whitelisted or blacklisted person even. So, well, you could see heuristics applied that actually block these kinds of spends. And so to the extent that we are able to spend more privately, it kind of defends the overall system in terms of how permissionless it really is. Because if more and more people are using CoinJoin and PayJoin and all of these privacy-preserving techniques, then it just becomes less feasible for as an example, mining pools to censor at their level to stop a transaction going through. That's just one example. Another example could be in various exchange and broker and OTC partners compliance desks, they might right now have to run all sorts of compliance checks. Or they might start looking at, okay, CoinJoin behavior is suspicious because only a small percentage of the Bitcoin population, as it were, uses CoinJoin. So therefore, CoinJoin usage, you're suspicious. We're going to stop your account. We're going to ban you. We're going to whatever. So these are some of the reasons why, even if you don't necessarily need every single one of your transactions to be 100% private, you still care about it as a system, that it is viable in the long term as a permissionless system.
Totally. Yeah, and so I should also put in the guidelines, we may go deep into a lot of terms and concepts. Do not be overwhelmed. You're going to learn a lot through osmosis, especially with these two up here, whether it's PayJoin, CoinJoin, and a number of other things. You guys touched on a good phrase, and you guys were in Miami earlier this week for the Oslo Freedom Forum. You guys were meeting a lot of dissidents. You were meeting a lot of folks that... Bitcoin could be a matter of life and death in terms of how they're using Bitcoin. I don't know if there's, and you know, we're privileged here that we are able to participate in the global financial system, I assume all of us. Was there any kind of big takeaway or big story that you guys want to share?
First of all, I mean, we had microphone issues in the beginning, so I was a little bit distracted. I do want to thank Rod and Mills for hosting us, and I want to thank all you guys for coming out. It's pretty crazy how packed a crowd it is here for the second Nashville Bitcoin meetup ever. And I wanted to thank, I think Bitcoin Magazine sponsored the drinks, dude. Right? So I wanted to thank Bitcoin Magazine for sponsoring.
Maybe I can have a quick plug there.
Long-term Nashville Bitcoin company, yeah. And a massive amount of the team is here. I absolutely love the team. Disclosure, I have been consulting for them for quite a while now. But they built a really great team over there, a lot of quality Bitcoiners. So if you are interested in working in Bitcoin, consider applying there. And then to take it back down, it was really humbling being at the Oslo Freedom Forum. You know, as Bitcoiners...
Maybe explain that just a little bit.
So the Oslo Freedom Forum is run by the Human Rights Foundation. They do it every year. They usually do it in Oslo. Because of COVID, everything's moving to Miami. Including the Oslo Freedom Forum. So this was the first time I got to be a part of it. I was actually supposed to fly out to Oslo previously. The first time I worked with them was in 2019. I flew out to San Francisco. I helped teach activists. Like, it was just 10 activists in a small little classroom. This time, Alex Gladstein, the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation, set up a whole Bitcoin Academy track. So they got to learn about Bitcoin from, you know, leading advocates and experts in the space, all sorts of different aspects of Bitcoin. Also, just the normal track of Oslo Freedom Forum as you hear from the activists around the world about their fight. And it's really dark. The reality is human rights around the world are being trampled on. These people are fighting for their lives. Bitcoin offers some hope. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of nuance about using it privately. And for them, you know, it really is a matter of life or death. If these authoritarians are able to track their transactions, they're able to see what their spending is, they're able to see exactly how much Bitcoin they hold. So I'll let Stefan speak after, so I'm not going to speak for him. But to me, it was just truly humbling. It gave me more inspiration for why I put so much effort into the Bitcoin space. But honestly, like I felt like a complete LARP. I felt like a complete LARP because these people are literally, you know, we talked to Bitcoiners and some Bitcoiners like, I don't want to try and use Bitcoin privately. Like Stefan kind of said earlier, like maybe it puts a target on your back. You know, maybe I'll end up in jail if it's considered suspicious or something like that. These people are getting thrown in jail 40, 50 times already just for being against the authoritarians that they push back against. They have friends and family that have been killed, brothers who just disappeared. You know, I cried multiple times during their presentations. And I just think that the big takeaway is that with Bitcoin, open source tools in general, they provide an answer on a technical level to a lot of oppression we see in the world today. And to me, there's no more practical fight, no more important fight than supporting open source development, supporting open source tools, empowering individuals, and you know, just trying to make the world at least a slightly better place than it is today. Because for these people, like it's not theoretical; it's already happening.
Yeah, and I totally agree with what Odell was just saying. I think it's very motivating when you see the stories of these people who are living under these kinds of conditions where if they, based on their political views, they're getting arrested regularly. These people are regularly being arrested, and they are essentially in and around circles of people who are political prisoners. They've not done like a genuine crime. They just spoke out against some kind of oppression or something wrong, and that's sent them into jail or had them disappeared and all sorts of horrific things. And so I had the chance to, in those side conversations, speak to some of the different human rights activists, and they were from all around the world. And some of them were now based in the US because they had been persecuted that they had to leave. And so if you talk to them and if you ask them, well, what's the banking situation like for you guys? And pretty much they all get this same answer of they get shut down, they get stopped, they get blocked, whatever it is. And so what I found for some of them is really seeing is believing. If you showed them, hey, pull out your phone, let's get you set up with Moon Wallet or Phoenix or one of these Bitcoin wallets.
Two use.
Yeah, and then you set them up. Sorry?
Moon with two U's.
Moon with two U's, correct, yes. And you send them a Lightning transaction, and their eyes light up. And so that was really interesting for them. And I think for them, it sort of shows them how real it could be. Or if you show them, hey, you can buy vouchers with this, or you can take donations with this. And another important lesson, even for those of us who are out there trying to talk about Bitcoin, I think one of the interesting things that HRF really do well is that they really focus on stories, because I think stories are what motivate a lot of us. And I think in my mind, it sort of reminds me every now and again, I'm like, you know what? I go down these random technical rabbit holes and I don't focus enough on an actual story that's engaging. And I think that is what can engage someone and pull them in to whatever you're trying to teach them about or advocate for. So that's probably an important lesson for all of us to think about as well.
Yeah, totally. Again, we're going pretty hard in the paint, especially on our second meetup with amazing guests around Bitcoin privacy. But I do think it's important. But one thing, and you know, it's going to be a little bit of a hot topic because probably, and I'm not going to ask who has bought Bitcoin, but I'm going to venture to guess. There you go. Flip over there has bought a lot of Bitcoin. Talk to him. We all, and including myself, we all bought it on a KYC exchange. And what's KYC? It's know your customer. You have to give them your driver's license. A lot of these exchanges, you're putting your face, you're putting your passport. You may have to like give your child's blood a little bit or something like that. That was a joke. And so I guess why is that? what are the trade-offs, I guess? Because the ease of use is great. You know, you can buy even with Strike, you know, and top up. What are the future trade-offs that some of the folks should be concerned about?
So actually, I mean, first of all, by a show of hands, who has never sent a Bitcoin transaction? Bartender, okay, liar, good OPSEC. Let's go. Okay. So we do have a good group of Bitcoiners in the crowd. I don't really like the term KYC. KYC stands for Know Your Customer. Usually goes KYC, AML with a slash in between. So Know Your Customer, anti-money laundering. What it really is every major company in the Bitcoin space is keeping lists of Bitcoiners and their transaction history. And they're not storing it securely. Sometimes it is being sold to marketers. It is being shared around with different surveillance firms. And these lists are ever growing and they're being collated. We just recently had Coinbase. They had 6,000 people's full transaction history, home address, social security number, you know, ID, driver's license. All this information gets leaked. And then from that information, if you don't take privacy best practices into account, it can, all your transactions can, you can, they can be tracked and they can be surveilled and they can make process of elimination decisions. So when we're looking at Bitcoin privacy, well, before I get there, the common claim is it's to stop criminals. And what's really, really frustrating about it is it doesn't actually stop criminals. Criminals either use stolen KYC data to set up accounts, or they actually buy KYC data. One of the, I guess cool is the wrong word, but one of the cool aspects about Bitcoin is it opens up these new markets. So there's actually markets on Tor where you can go onto the darknet and you can buy KYC information from like poor Nigerians or poor Ethiopians or people in the Philippines or people in Thailand, and they'll just sell you, they'll just sign up to Binance for you and you just pay them $40 worth of Bitcoin and then you can use their account. And they just need the money, so they don't really care if you use it for nefarious purposes. So criminals are getting away with doing whatever criminals want to do, and law-abiding citizens are being put at risk. And to me, I think, like, as an industry, we should take more of an example from gun owners in America and really start to stand up against this idea that it's just normal and expected for these companies to keeping major, major ever-growing lists of Bitcoiners, their personal information, and their transaction history. And then on a more practical basis, what is basically happening is you have this blockchain data that is forever, your Bitcoin transaction data that's living on this ledger that's gonna outlive all of us, and it's combined with external data, which is these lists and this transaction history. And when you combine the two, what these surveillance firms are doing is they're basically, everything they do is a probability game. So they're looking at the chain, and most of you probably realize you can send Bitcoin to yourself. So what they're trying to do is figure out what the probability is that I'm actually, say, sending money to Stefan versus sending money to myself. It's a probability game. So our tools that we can use on the side, if you are going to go through one of these regulated on-ramps and have your information connected, is to try and break these heuristics that they use to reduce that probability that they know that you're actually the owner of the Bitcoin is changing hands. And so the whole fight basically in Bitcoin privacy land is this idea of reducing the ability for them to figure out a high probability score of ownership change.
Correct. Yeah, so just to add, I guess the trade-offs with that, of course, and it's not like Bitcoin companies, you know, enjoy doing this KYC stuff. It's obviously something that has been forced on them at the risk of getting shut down. And pretty much any financial services company lives at the risk or lives under that threat of having their license taken from them and then not being allowed to operate. And of course, there are non-KYC methods of obtaining Bitcoin. You can mine it, you can earn it, you can purchase it on platforms like BISC and HODL and others. But I think the other trade-off on the KYC service or AML KYC service side is that you simply won't be able to accumulate as many coins. But the trade-off is that governments can subpoena that data or even ask for that data. So in Australia, it's basically assumed, like it's not even like a subpoena. It's more just like the government will just ask Australian Bitcoin exchanges, you know, we know this guy bought, you know, we know this guy's with you, give us his records. and it's basically assumed. So that's how bad it's gotten in Australia. So, you know, you have to think about that and trade that off. And you also have to think about this idea that once purchased, that record is always there, right? Even if you then coin join and get what we achieve, what we call forward privacy. So I buy the coins on the KYC exchange, I coin join them, and then from then on, yes, assuming I do the right steps, I run it through Tor, I run it through CoinJoin, etc., I have forward privacy from that point forward. But that record still exists. And so for some people who are really serious about privacy, they literally go back the way they came, meaning they sell on the KYC exchange. So they might have bought this amount and sold this amount and then gone and repurchased their entire stack non-KYC. Now, it's a spectrum in terms of how much of a cost you're willing to pay to do that. For, you know, you have to make your own assessment. How much is the additional coins, is that going to be worth to you in 10 years' time, 15 years' time? If we're all bullish as we are on Bitcoin and we think it's going to $10 million a coin, $15 million a coin.
Why so bearish? Yeah.
Too bearish. Canceled. So there are a few ideas there, but at the end of the day, I'm sort of interested in Bitcoin as a system remaining viable and sustainable. And so, you know, it also here's the other thing. If I'm too bearish, let's not forget the fee market or the block space market. The fees will rise. It will become more costly to use CoinJoin. Eventually. So that's something to think about as well. The cost to be private. Because remember, Bitcoin is designed, we view it more like a settlement layer. So yep, it's going to cost you a lot more to be private.
So Stefan, let me just jump in here real quick. First of all, long term, I think what we will see is we'll see more of a circular economy develop where you can go to the bar, you pay them in Bitcoin, you're not actually buying Bitcoin, you're not actually selling Bitcoin. You're earning Bitcoin or spending Bitcoin. And in that case, you don't have these regulated companies standing in between. The second thing I would add is, yes, these regulated companies are forced to comply with these laws, but we've watched many of them spend millions of dollars, sometimes tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, fighting for the ability to sell unregistered securities and sell shitcoins, but they haven't pushed back against this collection of information. So I'm not saying that I expect, you know, regulated companies to just break the law, but I would like to see some more pushback. We haven't really seen much pushback. And then the third thing is, you mentioned it briefly, but right now in the current dynamic, mining is a very accessible thing that you can do, and you can mine from home. It does involve a licensed electrician because you need 220 Yeah, you need 220, right?
220, 240. Depends.
Yeah, 220, 240.
I don't know personally because I don't do this.
But you need a licensed electrician. But what's really nice about that is it's permissionless. And in the current market, you can kind of, for most people at most energy costs in America, you're able to get Bitcoin actually at a discount of using through the regulated exchanges. And if we have small miners throughout the country, they can kind of jumpstart that circular economy. If they need to pay their bills, if they need some fiat, they need some cash, then, you know, at a local Bitcoin meetup or something like that, they're able to trade Bitcoin. So not only does it help the individual miner, it helps the network as a whole because we have more distributed miners rather than these large public corporations as miners. But it also helps jumpstart your local Bitcoin economy.
So as someone who may be scared shitless now, including myself. Quick recap. So we mentioned at-home mining. We mentioned CoinJoin, go forward, PayJoin. What about Lightning? Is Lightning help with...
So there's actually a lot of... Okay, here's how I think about it.
And by the way, Lightning, if you want to explain Lightning.
Okay, so for people who aren't familiar, Lightning is a network of payment channels built up on top of Bitcoin. And so you can think of it like when you open a bar tab and you close out that bar tab. That's like a very loose analogy, but think of it like it's not just that. It's actually that you don't need to open a bar tab with every person you pay. It's that there's a network, and that using the magic of cryptography and Bitcoin smart contracts, that essentially you can route a payment across the network, and the net result being you can make payments much more cheaply, and these payments do not necessarily hit the chain, as in touch the blockchain. That said, there are various ways in which you can leak your privacy on the Lightning Network. So here's high level how I think about it, right? So the least private of all is what I would call a naive on-chain spend, right? Just a, you know, not even trying any privacy techniques, just spending on-chain. Then a bit more private than that is Lightning, because you're not necessarily putting everything onto the blockchain. It might require active surveillance or some kind of more advanced techniques for somebody to figure you out. And then I think most private is CoinJoin off your own node using the correct tech, like a well-executed CoinJoin flow is probably what I think of as the best possible privacy available in Bitcoin today. So it's kind of 1, 2, 3 in that order. That's how I think of it. So Lightning has a lot of ways in which you can actually still be doxxed. Your channel, when you open that channel with somebody, that there are various elements of your coins that are being doxxed out to the network, because it's not just the Bitcoin blockchain. When we join the Lightning Network and we run a Lightning node, there's this thing called gossip data. So our Lightning nodes are all talking to each other and they're sharing information. And then that information could be used to sort of know what is your channel point, what is your on-chain footprint. So there are various techniques involved. A really good article if you're interested. And Anthony Broning wrote this, and I think you hosted him on Citadel Dispatch. I did an episode with him as well, episode 276 of my show.
I had him good first job. Though.
Yeah, you did.
Ooh.
And so that's a really great article if you're interested in like the really technical nuances of Lightning privacy. So there are a few opening thoughts. Do you want to add anything?
First off, if someone could grab me a pale ale, that would be appreciated. You know, he probably just confused a lot of people. I hope
Matt's
that,
a lightning bear.
Stefan's a lightning bear. Bull.
I use it myself.
I think when we win, it will be that you won't have, two nerds sitting up here for 45 minutes talking about the nuances of Bitcoin privacy. You'll just be able to just, open a mobile wallet and just spend in a relatively private fashion. Thank you, sir. I would add a couple things to what Stefan said. First of all, high level, Lightning is, for most people, you don't need to know about payment channels or anything. You install an app on your phone, you load it up with some Bitcoin, you're able to pay for less fees, faster transactions. Lightning in general at a high level has pretty strong privacy guarantees for senders. Most of the issues revolve around receiving Lightning transactions. So if you're sending Lightning transactions, you should get a bump up in privacy just across the board. And then last but not least, he said the three different ways. He said naive on-chain, Lightning, and then CoinJoin. But you can use them in combination. So what I really want to see is the fourth one, which is wallets basically automate. You do CoinJoin, and then you CoinJoin into Lightning, and then you make spends with Lightning.
Right, yeah. And so there's some interesting aspects with that. I think Anthony Roening's piece touches on some of these things of this idea that you would spin up a Lightning node, send some coin-joined money into that node, and then open one channel out of that. But then even from that point on, you might then dox other aspects of your setup. And so it kind of gets complicated. But I think where we're going longer term with things like Taproot and with things like someday channel factories and various techniques that will, once they've been developed and popularized and commercialized and put into wallets and software that we use, it'll be better then.
Lightning is very new, and there hasn't really been much focus on privacy. It's kind of just a secondary effect that has happened. So like there's been privacy advocates who have just kind of played around with it to try and use it as a privacy tool. So I hope more privacy development goes into it, more privacy focus goes into it. But one of the really cool aspects of Lightning, and to be honest, you call me a Lightning bear. One of the cool aspects of Lightning is Bitcoin doesn't change. Bitcoin is very difficult to change on the protocol level. And that's part of the value prop, because being easy to change is an attack vector, because you can change it in ways that make it worse money. So we have Bitcoin, which has very conservative development. And then we have layer two networks on top, like Lightning being the most used one and most famous one, that have very rapid change, and they're able to change very quickly, develop very quickly. So hopefully we see development there keep improving and keep making it more private and just a better experience. But at the same time, if Lightning fails, we'll have other layer two networks. It won't be the end of the world. And to me, that's the most bullish part about Lightning. The most bullish part about Lightning is it could disappear tomorrow, and it wouldn't be the end of the end of Bitcoin.
And I should have probably prefaced it by saying you cycle through bearishness, skepticism, yeah. Bullishness.
It's true.
Bearishness, skepticism.
And then he was talking about the fee market. I got pie in my face earlier in the year because I basically got fee FOMO, and I was like, the fees are just going to keep going up. And then they just went all the way down. You can like send a transaction now for like 120 sats. It's like, what is like 20 cents or something, 10 cents.
Yeah, exactly. Catan was right, unfortunately.
Yeah, our buddy Catan completely owned me on that one. But I do expect fees to go up. Yeah. Otherwise, we probably have some issues on our hands.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, if the fees don't go up by, say, you know, so 99% of all the Bitcoins that will ever be mined will be issued in 2035. So if the fee market and block space market, rather, doesn't happen by then, well, maybe the security element maybe might be a little bit more in question. But honestly, I'm not worried, to be honest. Like, I think we're going to see a lot more people using Bitcoin.
That actually reminds me, you know, the first step with Bitcoin privacy is you got to take your keys off of exchanges. You know, you're using, especially if you're using a KYC custodian, like they're holding your keys. They can see all of your transactions. They know your balances. They can seize all your money. And I think part of the reason why we've seen the fee market not really develop yet is because so many people just buy Bitcoin and they just hold it in the custodial wallet. They never actually withdraw it. And if they do withdraw it, they just do one transaction out. They don't take any privacy precautions. So the amount of transactions that are actually getting settled on the Bitcoin network are significantly lower because of these custodial platforms.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think there's a few factors going into it. I think the SegWit and batching also made a big difference. And the, for example, blockchain.info having enabled SegWit for a long time, they were not doing it. So that on the margin, that was a lot of transactions because a lot of people are using blockchain.info. So I think that was part of it. I think Lightning's taken a little bit off. I think more people are using stablecoins. And maybe there's less of a transactional culture in Bitcoin. It sort of became more and more of a saving.
Do not use blockchain.info.
Yeah, that goes without saying.
So one thing, and I lost my train of thought, but I'll ask one more question, and then maybe we open it up for the audience to have some questions as well. You know, one thing I was thinking about, that New York story, you know, someone's probably in the audience like, well, why didn't you just pay him, you know, the $20 in Bitcoin and use Lightning? I mean, back 3 years ago, Lightning wallets didn't really exist. I mean, you had to go to a terminal and, like, you know, hard code a transaction, basically. And then if I sent you a transaction on chain, $20, it would have been like $7 worth of fees. So that $20 worth of cash was A-okay. I guess I'll close with, you know, can the Bitcoin protocol, so layer one privacy, you mentioned Taproot, you mentioned a couple of these other things, can we get more private by default?
So the current hope is, there's a few. So Taproot will help in small ways. It will make certain transactions look the same. There is a hope of this idea of cross-input signature aggregation, although that's like a very far off and we don't know if we'll ever get that. There's also another kind of more far off idea of confidential transactions, which would help in terms of some of the privacy heuristics. But currently the trade-offs associated to get confidential transactions just make it untenable in terms of getting the users and the developers over the line in terms of getting them to agree with that. But I did a recent episode with Adam Back, episode 300, talking about some of those trade-offs, if you're interested about that. But
is that the only time you had him on?
Episode 42 was my first episode with him.
Damn,
you beat
Stefan.
Me on that one.
What about 83?
Is that Connor? I can't remember.
Oh,
I can't remember them all.
What about Citadel Dispatch 31?
That was the mining episode.
Dope.
But anyway, continue. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So the hope now, one positive hope that I have that's kind of recent is seeing Sparrow Wallet integrate Whirlpool. Now, I think this is really cool for a number of reasons because, you know, you guys might have seen that meme video of the first follower, right? Like this guy, this is the first guy's dancing crazy and whatever. Maybe in that analogy, it's like Samurai Wallet are the crazy ones and Sparrow Wallet was the first follower. And maybe some of the other wallets will actually integrate Whirlpool as well. And so then we'd have all these different wallets all mixing through the same protocol and becoming part of the same anonymity set and liquidity set, if you will. So that could be a positive development, and we might see more and more people using Bitcoin more privately in that way. And it's got some interesting features that previously were not easy. So, for example, mixing to your cold storage. That was something that was very difficult to do if you're just on your Samurai wallet on your mobile. But now with Sparrow, you can do that. Oh, actually, previously, you could have done something similar with Join Market. But again, Join Market is not as accessible. So I'm hopeful there that with some of the application level technology and software and hardware, potentially, that we'll get more privacy that way. But it's kind of up in the air right now.
Join Market was one of the first CoinJoin implementations. They're working to make it more accessible. I've actually been working with Human Rights Foundation. We set up a bounty, so it's easy to set up on your own node, all these node packages, whether it's Raspberry Blitz or Umbral or MyNode, you'll be able to easily use Join Market. I like to support all the privacy projects in the space. I am very, very excited about Sparrow. That's sparrowwallet.com. Craig Raw from South Africa developed it. He basically made a wallet that he wanted to use. It has very few dependencies. It's very reliable. It's just very efficient. I actually convinced him on Citadel Dispatch Live to add Whirlpool, which is pretty cool. I do not remember the number, even though I've had way less episodes than you. But you can just check it if you want. But I don't think confidential transactions will ever happen. The idea of confidential transactions is that the amount is blinded, not the sender receiver, but the amount is blinded. And what's nice about that is all CoinJoin implementations up until this point relied on equal amounts. So when you send a CoinJoin transaction, a CoinJoin transaction at its core is a collaborative transaction. It's this idea that you send a transaction with multiple people and you all get increased privacy because that probability game, like we were talking about earlier, it breaks the probability. You don't know which one is which person because you all shared it together. If you add confidential transactions to the mix and you can't see the amount, then they don't have to be the equal amounts. Right now, the CoinJoin implementations rely on the fact that you're all coming in at equal amounts because the amounts can be seen. All that said, I highly doubt confidential transactions are ever going to happen on Bitcoin. So the dream is really on the app level. And that's what Stefan was talking about earlier. Apps like Sparrow Wallet, apps like Samurai, apps like Join Market can implement it on the wallet level. As more people start using it on the wallet level, everyone gets increased privacy. And what I expect is I'm actually really bullish on Bitcoin privacy long term, because I think regardless of privacy, Bitcoin is going to take over the world. And that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of so-called like privacy coins, where like these coins focus on trying to make private transactions, and I don't focus my time on them because Bitcoin's going to win regardless of what happens. So the goal should be to try and make Bitcoin as private as possible. And what I think happens is what's going to happen in all of our everyday lives is that as more of our lives become digital, as more of our lives start to use Bitcoin, as more of our lives just in every day, you buy a concert ticket, you buy this, you buy something on Amazon, goes digital, we're going to get burned, and we're all going to start to get burned. The leaks are going to get worse. We just had Facebook. I think it was like 1.8 billion people's records got compromised on Facebook. As people start to get burned, they're going to realize the need to increase their privacy. And I think Bitcoin as this open, permissionless way of innovation, like you can innovate on top of Bitcoin and no one can stop you, will result in kind of market forces that push people into these better privacy solutions. So the way I look at it is Bitcoin will be easy to use privately eventually. And the difference is it'll either be really messy in the middle and we'll all get burned, or we avoid that process. But at the end, it'll be easy to use it privately. Like that's kind of how I view it.
Yeah, interesting. And actually, let me ask you a question as well, because you said Bitcoin's gonna win regardless, which I agree with. There is an interesting hypothetical, and I think SafeTeam put this one up a while back, but he said this idea of, imagine if every sat was KYC'd, and would you regard Bitcoin as a failure at that point, or would you still see it as an improvement?
Well, that will never happen. But in that theoretical, then Bitcoin is no longer permissionless. If you have to ask permission to spend your Bitcoin, it's not your Bitcoin. And if every transaction is known, then people will self-censor themselves. They can get their, like, the thing is, like, Bitcoin's hard to seize, but it's not hard to throw you in jail for doing a transaction you weren't allowed to do in the first place, right? So privacy is key to the censorship-resistant aspect of Bitcoin. So in that straw man theoretical, and every UTXO, every SAT is KYC'd, to me, Bitcoin will have failed. The price still might pump, but I would hope that there'd be pushback before we got to that point.
Yeah. And look, it is an unrealistic hypothetical. I agree. It's just an interesting thought.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Would Bitcoin have failed at that point?
I think the main problem is more about the government's tentacles getting into a lot of things, because the government is what forces AML and sanctions controls onto all these businesses. I think it would, so like you were saying, it's an unrealistic hypothetical in that not every SAT will be KYC'd. But here's the other thing. It might be that there are different countries or jurisdictions or citadels, as we might say, that have different rules. And maybe some of them, it is KYC'd, but you're allowed to just spend what you want. And so it might allow more of a competitive jurisdiction aspect. And that, in turn, might give people more freedom in a way that maybe is not implied. Yep. It's not the same future that you've implied.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty shitty thought experiment, to be honest.
I find it interesting.
Thanks, Stefan.
Yeah.
No, I'm just joking. Any questions from the audience? We can do this. Yes, Emily, you enunciate, I'll repeat. The next frontier for Bitcoin, assuming it's taken over the world, where is that next battle? Is that a fair recap?
Okay. I think it'll be those countries that really go hard on Bitcoin first. You know, maybe El Salvador will be one of the first places where if they stick with this thing, a lot of people in that country will get a lot richer than people in other countries, because they will have been day-to-day native using Bitcoin. That's one example. But I think it's also just people who hold a lot of coin right now will kind of drive that competitive pressure amongst the different states. And maybe some of the smaller, it might not necessarily be like the Australia, US, UK, Canada. It might be some of the smaller nations that are maybe a little bit more nimble and actually offer a bit more freedom. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general what you see with Bitcoin is it's the challengers that adopt Bitcoin first and end up benefiting from it more. So you tend to see disadvantaged people get it first. You tend to see the secondary companies, not the top tier company isn't the first one who adopts it. It's the secondary company. You see countries like El Salvador adopt it before a large GDP nation. And at some point that will change, but in the short to medium term, it'll probably continue to be kind of, you know, countries, companies, individuals that have something to prove, something to truly fight for, that will adopt it first. And that's kind of, you know, that's one of the most beautiful aspects of Bitcoin to me, at least in the adoption cycle, because, you know, Bitcoin doesn't like magically fix income inequality or make the world necessarily, you know, more financially equal. But it does guarantee you a fair money. And it guarantees you the ability to fight on a fair playing field where the money isn't necessarily working against you or being co-opted by super powerful forces. Thank you, Emily.
Yeah, gentleman in the back. So with Chinese miners coming over, especially to Texas, especially with flared gas in West Texas, seeing the federal versus the state level, do you see like a Texas, Wyoming, Tennessee, hopefully North Dakota, South Dakota kind of saying, hey, we're going to create our own rules versus the federal coming down with a federal mandate? Is that fair, Rico?
Will we see like the states' rights? He's basically asking, will we see like states' rights become a bigger issue in Bitcoin?
Well, we're seeing in Wyoming too.
Make some states, I guess, more likely to try and execute that strategy, right? Would you say that's a fair...
And who are the players?
Oh, okay. So as in, which would they support the privacy aspect of it as well? That's probably more complicated. I think in terms of just broadly supporting Bitcoin, I think if there are a lot of jobs in that area, then the politicians will be a lot more inclined to be amenable to that. So Texas and having a lot of Bitcoin mining, people like Ted Cruz and others, he'll be out there saying, yeah, look, let's rah-rah Bitcoin, right? So there might be a bit of that, but in terms of the privacy angle, that's probably a harder question. I don't think I could offer an intelligent.
You know, first of all, I think private Bitcoin usage is protected by the Constitution of the United States. The First and Fourth Amendment, the first being free speech,
And the fourth being unreasonable search and seizure. If you're not using a third party, because we have the third party doctrine, which is why it's important to use it with your own node, holding your own keys. And I would like to see more constitutional fights on that level. But you also have, I believe it's the 14th Amendment, which is states' rights. And I want to see it protected on that level as well. So I want to see more constitutional law kind of plays with Bitcoin. I expect states to start doing it. I expect, once again, to go back to the previous question, the challenger states to kind of step up first, who have less to lose, who have been, you know, completely destroyed economically in a lot of ways. But with Texas, you know, it's a very interesting beast because they are a powerhouse. And while it's nice to see the mining industry grow down there, and I very much support the use of... we didn't repeat that part of the question, but waste natural gas that's just being put out into the atmosphere and is horrible for the environment. There's actually an incentive now to be better for the environment, a direct financial incentive by capturing that waste gas and turning it into Bitcoin. We are the land of KYC. And when you look at international exchanges, a lot of times it's not their own governments that force them into complying with KYC laws and lists of Bitcoiners. It's the American government that does it. We had a major exchange called BitMEX, right? BitMEX didn't want to implement KYC AML. They were based in the Seychelles. They were forced to implement it because the U.S. government said to them, if you don't implement KYC, Americans might use it. So you have to KYC every single one of your customers to make sure the Americans don't use it. And then we used, you know, our 8 aircraft carriers or whatever to make sure that that policy was enforced, right? They threw 2 of the founders in jail. The third founder ultimately bent the knee and settled with them, and now they're fully KYC'd AML'd. So the more miners we have in America, that becomes more of a risk to me. And, you know, as much as I love this country, I think it's important for us as Americans to, like, keep our guard up and at the very least, you know, try and support, you know, mining firms that are pushing back against unwarranted regulation against them that is ultimately worse for Americans and worse for people around the world.
Yeah, I'll just add there as well, even with the international censorship pressures, you got FATF, right? Financial Action Task Force. And so sometimes it goes either way. So one of my episodes with Jake Chavinsky, he talks about how it kind of sometimes it's pushed from the country level. And in other cases, it's pushed from like a FATF level, because the FATF will then push it down to that country and say, oh, look, you naughty little country, you're not doing enough KYC, AML, you're on the blacklist. And we're going to try to stop you in terms of banking. And so then that country now faces pressure. Either the legislators or the regulators of that country have pressure on them. Oh, we need to push KYC onto our banks, financial services, and to Bitcoin companies. And so that's a bit of that pressure game that goes on there. But maybe an interesting example, though, is Bukele with El Salvador, sort of almost giving the middle finger to the IMF. Maybe there is a scenario where maybe some country governor or a state governor starts giving the middle finger to FATF. We don't know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the question was countries, authoritarian countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo just shut down internet, shut down text messages. They go the full 9 yards to try and quash any kind of opposition to them. And how can Bitcoin be more robust against that? I would say that, you know, when people see a need, a true need, and this is one of the things I really took away from the Oslo Freedom Forum by the HRF, is they will find a way, right? And I think, you know, for people in those types of situations, you don't have to explain the need for Bitcoin. You can skip that whole first step. You just have to explain to them and help them how can they access it, how can they use it. And I think the important part is, you know, at least on our side, me and Stefan's side, like, you want to support the tools, you want to make the education, you want to have it there for people. So when they realize that need, they can come and learn for themselves and take their own journey and try and make it happen. But I think ultimately, like, every attack against Bitcoin makes the network more robust. And frankly, to be honest, you know, between the competition between countries, between
like the way that the Bitcoin network is now, I think it's extremely robust. Like, I think we're very well situated in terms of state resistance on the network level. My bigger concern is on the actual individual user level. And, you know, if you're a developed country, like, you know, that's a weapon of mass destruction, shutting off the internet for your whole, for everything, right? So the low-hanging fruit is you attack users. And specifically what you do is, and hopefully this is not prescient, you attack the users that are outspoken about these causes, like me and Stefan, and then you make an example out of us, and then everyone else kind of just falls in line and complies, right? Because that's, you know, unfortunately, especially over the last 2 years, that's the unfortunate reality. The unfortunate reality is if you scare people enough, you make examples out of a few people, the majority of people will fall in line, and you don't have to go through those drastic measures in the first place.
Yeah, so just to add to that, I think it's about building a social movement that there's enough people out there who just want their freedom and chase it. One other thing I'll just add on the developing country. Like, I just came from Sri Lanka recently as well. So I was there, I was born there, right? So I was raised in Australia, so I had the luck to be raised in a Western world nation. And talking to some of my cousins, it's bleak when your income is really low. You just can't save, right? So the average, you know, a person in Sri Lanka might be earning, if I were to US dollarize that income, it might be $5,000 or $6,000 a year, or maybe a little bit more, right? But imagine living on $6,000 a year. Like, it's very hard for you to save when your income is just simply that low. And it might even be difficult for you to use Bitcoin non-custodially when your income is that low. And so that's why in El Salvador, we're seeing things like Bitcoin Beach by Galoy doing this idea of like a community lightning bank and things like that, because you just can't afford it otherwise. And so that's one of the difficulties there. But I think education and over time, and especially this might be like my friend Hass McCook with his DCA army message of, you know, if enough people start stacking sats hard, you monetize Bitcoin globally, and then that's actually how you can save people in the developing countries, because quite frankly, there's a wealth and income disparity that is just so immense.
He also called privacy dev spooks, though.
Yeah, so look, I don't agree with his views there, but I agree on his DCA army.
CK.
So the question was, how big does the anonymity set have to get in terms of CoinJoin or privacy techniques, privacy users who are using privacy techniques for this basically to be a viable thing?
And then anonymity set being like this idea in privacy that you're only as private as the crowd that you're among. If only like 10 people are seeking privacy, it's very easy to just realize those 10 people are using, you know, the privacy methods. That's not just a Bitcoin thing. That's just a normal, you know, it's a privacy meme almost, but it's a real aspect, yeah, to privacy in general. And then CK asked, like, when can we see larger Bitcoin anonymity set? Specifically with CoinJoin, I think it's going to be a while. You know, I've spent, you know, 2 years not shutting up about it. And it's grown quite a bit. I mean, Whirlpool right now,
it's like 3,000 or 4,000 Bitcoin.
No, it's at like 4,300 Bitcoin. And I see some, you know, people wearing their Apple Watches. I know some of you have the Bitcoin price on there. Bitcoin price is up right now. So I think it's at an all-time high, both in dollar terms and Bitcoin terms. It's probably like I'm horrible at live math.
All right, let's do it. So 40, how many?
4,200 Bitcoin at 55K. Is, I think, a quarter of a million.
Yeah.
It's a quarter of a million. It was great math. A quarter of a billion.
Yeah, well, that was
mass. That's pretty big. But we need to see that number go up. And I think ultimately, and it just goes back to the previous question, ultimately, like, people just need to get burned really before they start to realize the need. I think the tools have improved, so it is easier to use now. And we were talking about Sparrow Wallet. It's extremely easy to use. You install the wallet, you connect it to your own node. You can just use it with Bitcoin Core if you want. Super easy to use now, relatively cheap. And that should help it increase. But ultimately, people need to get burned, yep, I think, before that number really goes up significantly.
Yeah.
Bull Rogers, 3 tips to improve your Bitcoin privacy.
If privacy is important, then step one, acquire the coins non-KYC. Step two is run your own Bitcoin node. And step three is like use CoinJoin wallets, like Samurai Wallet and Sparrow Wallet would probably be my kind of easy 1, 2, 3 steps.
Avoid KYC as much as possible. Hold your own keys. Use your own node. Learn privacy best practices. Cell phones are horrible for privacy. We're literally just walking around with surveillance trackers on us. I mentioned the Apple Watch. It's just a modern day cattle tag that you guys all have on you. There are certain techniques you can use with your cell phones to improve your privacy situation. I have covered them on Citadel Dispatch. I really like Calyx OS, which is an open source fork of Android with Google removed from it. It's still a surveillance device, but at least it reduces it somewhat. And it's just all about that privacy versus convenience trade-off. The true privacy advocates don't have a phone, period. I run Calyx. You know, I'm got my face on here, you know. The privacy advocate that talks publicly about privacy.
He's also the co-founder of Bitcoin TV.
The question is, what do we think of ransomware and governments going after Bitcoin and our privacy to fight ransomware? And how that should how we expect that to play out?
Yeah, so some of it is a real risk, right? But I also see it like I could imagine that being a big fight angle. I could imagine that being a big look at these illegal hackers and see how bad Bitcoin is. It's being used by the hackers and so on. So there will be a bit of a narrative battle about that. And I think people who are advocating and from a human rights point of view and from a in anti-inflation or anti-fiat money point of view, we'll have to make that case. I think there will be a lot of resources put into chain surveillance. So, you know, Coinbase are putting money into that. The Chainalysis of the world are getting government contracts to do spying on people and to have that sort of exchange relationship. So these are all, yeah, they're a bit concerning. And what you'll see is actually really interesting on this sort of stuff as well is Ergo BTC from the Samurai Camp. He's part of OXT Research. He often does some research reports on some of these hacks, and he'll trace it through. And funnily enough, he ends up tracing it through some exchanges and being like, this money went to Binance. So someone knows who this person is. So certainly very interesting guy to follow in terms of his ability to trace things on chain. He's like a white hat on chain analyst. So he's an interesting perspective there.
I mean, increasing ransomware attacks will be used against Bitcoin, will be used against Bitcoin privacy advocates and people who attempt to use Bitcoin privately. Will be used as an excuse to enforce greater KYC laws and make them even more burdensome and more dangerous. Ransomware is not Bitcoin's fault. We've entered the era of digital money. There's no going back now. These companies need to secure their data better. They shouldn't get hacked in the first place. No one blames cash when someone gets kidnapped and you have a duffel bag of cash to pay the kidnapper. If anything, Bitcoin makes the ransom more safe because you don't have to actually have that physical transaction. And then the ultimate irony of ransomware is the really dangerous ransomware is, so the basic ransomware is a hacker gets access to corporate systems, they encrypt all of your data. So they don't actually steal your data, they just encrypt it, and then they have the key. So to get the key back, you have to pay them. And once you pay them, they actually, most of the time, they'll give you the key because they just want to get the easy payment, and they want people to know that if you keep paying them, if they do it at scale, that you can pay them and you can reliably get the key back. The new breed of ransomware actually a lot of times takes the data hostage as well. And the unfortunate reality is ransomware is going to be used as a reason to collect more information on people. And then that information is going to get stolen by the ransomware hackers and make ransomware even more profitable for them because then they can go and sell that data. So the strategy that's going to be used, unfortunately, to try and fight ransomware is actually going to be making ransomware more dangerous and increase the incentive for it in the first place. And, you know, ultimately it's used as an attack against Bitcoin and just, you know, encryption in general. I hope that, you know, enough people start pushing back and saying that it's unreasonable and puts Americans at risk.
Maybe we wrap up with two questions, Ben.
Okay, so the question is, what are the top two things we would like to see Bitcoin open source developers do to improve privacy.
Or wallets and exchanges.
Wallets and exchanges.
You're giving this one to me first.
Yeah.
I want to see more privacy development. You know, I don't think, you know, we need like the 28th KYC on ramp. You know, like maybe I'm being a little bit of a dick because I'm not coding it, you know, so I just get up here and just push for it. But, you know, I want to support developers that are focused on privacy in a free open source way. And I want to see less, you know, money going to these just the 28th, the 29th, the 30th KYC on-ramp that's regulated. And then the second thing is it's not even a development thing. I want to see the existing regulated companies start putting money on the side to fight for users' privacy. Like I expect them to comply with the laws, but you know, pay up and fight. Like actually try and push back and try and reduce some of this, you know, oversteps. Because all we've seen is it get worse and worse and worse and worse. We haven't seen any pullback.
Yeah. So I think So privacy development, maybe an example might be Lightning privacy stuff, like opening channels with a coin join. I don't know, people like Lisa Nygaard are talking about stuff like that, dual funded channels and things, or maybe like Lightning wallets that also combine coin join. But right now there's no one that sort of, you either do one or the other well, there's no one who's sort of doing both. Maybe that's an angle. So
I would love to see that. Coin join plus Lightning could be really interesting.
Like imagine if you had like Samurai wallet plus, I don't know, Zeus or something like that, you know, like that might be a interesting.
I literally pressured Evan, the lead maintainer of Zeus, while we were on stage at HRF. I was like, he's going to be the first Lightning wallet to implement CoinJoin.
That's right.
So now he has no choice.
That's right. So that's one idea. And I think some of the, like the lobbying stuff, I think is like, I think people get frustrated because they sort of sense like there's not much you can do about it, but that like these people in this government are just putting out this more regulation, and they're kind of creeping. Even now this new thing of every transaction under, what is that, $600?
$600, yeah.
Right, so like it's not even just a Bitcoin thing, it's just a life and just financial services in general. They're just closing the doors, and shutting the gates and trying to push everyone. So
I think one thing is think big and act a little small. You're probably, there's somebody that's connected to some politician, somebody that owns one of these companies. Have those conversations. We've invited a number of local politicians, and I hope they are going to come to these future meetups and just have these conversations. Get them to use Bitcoin. Get them to understand Bitcoin. Because once you use it, I mean, we have Senator Lummis that disclosed, I think it was today or yesterday, her purchase of Bitcoin. And she's continuing to fight the good fight.
Yeah, and she was fighting the $600 thing as well.
Totally. Totally.
I mean, the $600 thing is a very interesting point. Like, I know, like, we kind of sounded like Debbie Downers up here. I want to be absolutely clear that Bitcoin is a massive step improvement over the legacy financial system. Like, if you use Venmo, you have no privacy. Like, the majority of my peers are using Venmo and credit cards and Cash App, and they just have no privacy whatsoever.
Disclosure.
So, when I'm talking shit, I don't have to disclose. Cash App, sponsor the podcast. So Bitcoin is a step improvement, a massive step improvement. And we already have tools that make it easier to use Bitcoin privately. Those tools will get better. Improvements will be made. Those will make the tools even better. And I'm definitely optimistic long term. And I think Bitcoin is a massive net benefit for privacy in general.
So maybe I'll make a few announcements and then maybe ask you guys just to have some closing thoughts and so on. So thanks again for everybody coming out. We alluded to a number of topics. We alluded to custody, mining, Lightning. So our next meetup for this group, you know, whoever wants to sign up, it's going to be on November 10th. The topic is going to be why is custodying Bitcoin yourself super vital and important? We're going to have some folks from Unchained, River, potentially, and others coming in town. And then on December 8th, it's going to be at-home mining. Dr. FOMO and I, we're going to work on that. That's you, buddy. And then in January 12th, it's going to be Lightning-focused. So the reason why I was super excited, and thanks to these guys again for spending time with us, is to really set the base around why Bitcoin privacy is so important before we accumulate as many sats as humanly possible and live a super awesome life. So, and one other thing, David Bailey in the back. Yeah, I saw you sneak in. He's the CEO, and he was my cue, by the way, to give the Bitcoin Magazine guys a shout out. But thanks again to them for sponsoring the drinks tonight. They are literally, not to dox them, but it's on Google, so they're right across the street. And they're a huge, huge Bitcoin company here in Nashville, Tennessee. So thanks again to those guys. Do you want to make an announcement? Okay. They got something cool in the works. Potentially it'll be on Twitter tomorrow. And thanks to Jackalope. Please tip your bartenders. They are awesome to work with here as well. So, Matt.
Thank you, Rod. I want to thank Mills as well, the co-host of Nashville Bitcoiners. I want to thank Nashville. I love your city. It's a great city. I just, you know, I don't want people to be discouraged. I think, you know, take your own journey. Don't get overwhelmed. Small steps, small improvements help. Every little thing you can cut out of your life that hurts your privacy does help. It does make a difference. You know, unplug your Alexa, unplug your Google Home, take off the smartwatch. The little things, it's important. I want to thank Bitcoin Magazine for sponsoring. I literally spent like 7 hours at their office today going over Bitcoin 2022. It's going to be absolutely insane. It's going to be in Miami, April 6th through 9th. 55,000 people. They tell me no, but I think it's going to be 55,000 people. The largest Bitcoin only conference in the world.
I don't know your track record on price predictions.
You can. And, we're going to be over 200K by conference day. You can buy your ticket at b.tc/conference. If you use code 1Trillion, you get 21% off. You pay with Bitcoin, you get a discount. I don't think that price will ever be cheaper than it is today. You will get FOMO in like May. No, May's afterwards. You will get FOMO in like February, March, and end up paying way more money to go. So consider buying your ticket now. My two shows are Citadel Dispatch and Tales from the Crypt. Open up your favorite podcast app, ideally a podcasting 2.0 app, so you can stream sats using Lightning. Just load it up with sats. Go to newpodcastapps.com. You can look up the podcasting 2.0 apps. Once again, thank you all. I really do appreciate you. Bitcoin is going to the fucking moon. We're going to change the fucking world together. Uh-huh. Stay humble, stack sats.
All right. So, yeah, I think there are different ways you can go about this, right? You can start by just earning non-KYC if that's important. You can use easy wallets like Sparrow. You can use Samurai Wallet and you just get started and then step up to things like, say, Ronin Dojo, running that as your own backing node for your Samurai Wallet, or run your own Electrum server as the backing for your own Sparrow wallet. So these are some steps you can take along the way if you're interested in the non-KYC element of this. And, you know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing, right? So you can have, like, not everyone agrees with me on this, but you can have, like, some KYC coins and some non-KYC coins. So I think you can sort of have a foot in both worlds there. So that's another idea that you can take from that. So at the end of the day, I think it comes back to what I was saying before about the overall system, that if it's permissionless and censorship resistant, then that's going to help make Bitcoin more successful in the long run, that it's like if the coins are, and you can spend it in a way that's actually fungible and not doxing your stack or doxing your wallet to people when you, every time you make a spend or you receive coins. So there are a few interesting elements just for you guys to think about. And of course, if you're interested, I've got lots of episodes on my show where I've interviewed many privacy advocates and privacy developers, people like Matt, people like Samurai Wallet, people like Ergo, various others who are working on this. So you can find me online, stefanlevera.com, and of course, swanbitcoin.com as well. I work for Swan, so you can buy with us, and we're Bitcoin only, so you can send them to us. That's it for me. Thanks for having us. Thanks to Bitcoin Magazine for sponsoring. Thanks to Rod and Mills for hosting us. Thank you guys for showing up.
Thank you, everybody.
Cheers.